This is Scan, and I'm Hal Dragseth. Carolyn Coons is a college professor, and by outward appearances seems to have lived a normal life. The truth is, she's had to overcome tremendous pain in her early life.
Being raised in an alcoholic home where my father was very abusive, very violent, very, very alcoholic, a person who didn't know what love is. He didn't know how to share love. He probably had never been loved in his life. And the only thing that he knew how to do is to interject that onto his own family. I have so many vivid memories of growing up in my family. But probably one of the strongest ones is when I was 8 years old. We were living in Southern California, and I'll never forget as I was in my bedroom and I discovered a loaded 38 caliber gun in my bedroom. It was hidden in a little closet area. And when I discovered it, I'm hiding around in my bedroom and I see this gun and the bullets and everything in the chamber. And my mother walked into the bedroom and saw me with that gun. And she screamed, grabbed it out of my hand, took it in her own hand and pointed it to my face. And as I stood there backed up against the wall, my mother, totally by now out of control, her fingers were on the trigger and I could see the bullets in the chamber. She is saying, "Your dad hates your guts. He hates your guts. He hates your guts." And she pointed this right into my nose. And she says, "One of these days he's going to kill you. And I am the only thing that is keeping him from killing you. You better pray that he dies before I die because I'm the only thing that's keeping him from killing you." And I'm telling you, that memory absolutely just seared in me. That gun and so many things had already happened in my life that made me remember that my dad didn't love me, but I had no idea his anger was so violent that he could kill me. Some of the things that I remember is probably another one in our family, being raised in this alcoholic home. We didn't celebrate things like what I understood most families did. We didn't celebrate birthdays. We didn't celebrate Christmases. We just lived sort of a secret life, a very distant kind of life from everybody else. And I'll remember as for 1 year, I had two older brothers, and for this strange year, my folks gave out Christmas gifts. My older brother got a beautiful Swin bicycle. And, you know, it was wonderful. It was a top Swin, and everyone thought it was the most wonderful bike. And then my next brother, Gary, he's 2 years older than I am. Well, Gary, he begged for a bicycle for his birthday, and so my folks got him this beautiful 3-speed bicycle out. So, of course, my birthday's coming along, and I'm wanting a bicycle, too. And being the youngest, I'm sure I made my wishes known, but I was also very careful how I did that. When my birthday came along, no one even said anything that morning. I didn't get happy birthday or any kind of a comment. Later on that day, my folks got in this argument. And my father drove away from the house in our red pickup truck. And about an hour and a half later, he backed into the driveway. And I thought, aha, I'm getting my bicycle too. And I stood back there waiting for him. And as he drove in, he parked the truck. He got out of the truck. He reached down into the back of the pickup truck and lifted up above his head one of the worst-looking bicycles you could have ever seen. It was all rusted out. The front wheel was bent sideways. Most of the spokes were missing. The paint was off of it. And he held it above his head, and he says, "I've been to the dump." And he says, "I got your blankety-blank bicycle." And he lifted it up above his head, and he threw it at me, and I had to jump out of the way. And as the bike crashed down before me, he's screaming at me. He says, "Don't you ever, ever, ever ask for anything again from me as long as you live." And I looked at him and I looked at that bicycle and I said to myself, "Don't worry, I won't." But you know, there's something about the bicycle, though. I picked it up and I decided that, well, at least it was something. For the first time in my life, I've got a bicycle. And so I took it in the garage and I tried to fix it all up and I tried to repair the spokes and everything. I painted it this beautiful blue color, and several days later I finally had my bicycle that worked. And I remember driving it out and down the street and back, and it was so heavy and so awkward, but at least it was my bicycle. I came back and I parked it in the driveway right next to my brother's Swin and my other brother's 3-speed bike, and I looked at that bicycle and I could hear my parents inside the house yelling at each other and cussing at each other. And I looked at those three bicycles and it just hit me. It hit me so hard. I just said, "I know these people are my folks. They're my parents. And I just have a feeling that nothing is ever going to be different. And if I'm going to make it, I'm going to have to make it on my own. And so what happened was I just decided that I was going to live on my own from then, even though I was living in the house, that if I was going to survive, it was going to have to come from me, not from them. And so I started out at a very early age deciding that I was going to make it and that I was going to survive. And from that point on, I tried everything I knew to try and make it. When you decide something that young and you decide you're on your own, I literally lived in the streets. I didn't want to go home. I mean, who wants to go home to a father that when you walk in the door, you don't know if he's going to be drunk, you don't know if he's going to pass out, you don't know if he's going to grab a belt and start beating you, you don't know if you're going to get cussed out or ridiculed like you've always been. So I spent my life on the streets and down at the local park just to stay away from home. When I made this decision, I was about 9 years old. And that's very young. My folks never gave me anything. Then I decided I was going to have to get it on my own. So I would go steal bicycles, you know, and I'd just come home with a new bicycle every week. And then I would dump it and I'd grab another bicycle. Or I started getting into all kinds of trouble. I would start stealing things at school or stealing from the neighbors. I'm sure I was the kid on the block that all the neighbors and all the people that knew me wish I didn't live there. I was the kind of kid that, you know, inside of me there was so much anger and so much frustration, and I kind of lived a life of secrecy and on my own that maybe I'd be just down to the local school on a Saturday, and if no one was around, I remember so many times just breaking into the school and taking a baseball bat or anything and maybe breaking into the principal's office and just, you know, hitting things, just smashing them. Just total out-of-control vandalism. One time I got caught, though, and I was very fortunate to get caught, is that there was a local church just a couple of blocks down the street. And I remember I would go down there on Sundays and I'd sit across the street on the curb and I would watch all these cars pull up and all these people dressed in nice clothes get out and they would hug their kids and everyone would go running off to these buildings. And one day I broke into that church. And I always wanted to know what it was like on the inside of that place. No one ever invited me and I didn't know what they were doing. Got inside of that church. And I remember walking around this beautiful sanctuary and back through the back section and everything. It was beautiful. I'd never seen anything like that. But again, all this stuff in me started coming out. I went back and I found some Bibles and some tracts and some candles. And then I had all the loot. Then I didn't know what to do with it. So I took it outside. I broke in underneath of the church. And I laid it all out there. And then I still didn't know what to do with it. So I lit a match to it. Decided I was going to burn it. And the fire was really getting big and out of control, and fortunately, I got caught by the pastor and the fire chief. In my sixth grade, probably a real turning point, at least for a little brief time, was we were having all the classes. I was always in trouble. I was getting sent off to the principal's office regularly. I was flunking most of my classes. The teachers would practically pull their hair out because they had Carolyn Coons in their class. And I'll never forget, in the sixth grade, for a while, we had a student teacher. His name was Mr. Franklin. And Mr. Franklin was wonderful. In fact, you know, like most student teachers, we loved the student teacher more than we liked the master teacher. And I'll never forget Mr. Franklin because everyone just thought he was the greatest person that ever lived. And after one of the PE classes, which I usually was able to disrupt even the PE classes, I just drove the poor teacher up the wall. Franklin took me aside and walked me away so the rest of the class could carry on their PE activities. And he sat me down and he says, "I've been observing you." And he says, "I'm going to be really honest with you. I don't know if anyone's ever been honest with you before." He says, "But you know what? Most people think you're pretty bad. And they think you're headed for a lot of trouble. But I've been watching you," and he says, "you know what? You're not fooling anybody." He says, "I think that deep down inside of Carolyn Coons is really a good person. My prayer for you is that you spend the rest of your life trying to find the good Carolyn Coons." I couldn't believe it. I mean, for the first time in my life, someone actually thought I was good. I mean, no one had ever told me I was good. I was always reinforced and told by friends, by relatives, by the neighbors how terrible I was. And of all people, Mr. Franklin, who everyone thought was wonderful, had singled me out and told me I was a good person. I mean, I had sort of an instant turnabout in my life. I was going to be good. No more stealing, no more getting in trouble, because I was going to live up to the expectation of Mr. Franklin. We went back into the classroom right after that conversation, and all the class was getting back in, and my desk was way in the back corner as usual. And as everyone was kind of getting ready to sit down, I remember saying to myself, wait a minute, I had two of my friends outside stealing two bicycles. I mean, if I didn't get bicycles, it was very easy how you get them, that during, you know, break times, you moved them from one end of the campus to the other end, so when everyone after class went to get their bicycle, you just took out the other door, and their bicycle was hidden at the other end of campus, and you drove off the campus. Well, my two buddies were moving bicycles, and I thought, wait a minute, Mr. Franklin thinks I'm good. I can't do that anymore. So I ran out the back door before the teacher saw me. I ran over the bike rack. Sure enough, they already had the bikes cut loose. They were wheeling them away, and the big hero, Carolyn Coons, I stood up and I says, wait a minute, guys, we're not going to steal bicycles anymore. And they said, what? I says, we're not stealing bicycles anymore. We're not going to do this. And I am practically pushing them back into the bike racks. Okay. Just as we are putting the bicycles back in the racks. And I was so proud that I was actually doing something good. I was living up to Mr. Franklin's expectation. I felt two hands grab me around the neck and the shoulder as hard as they could be. It hit me so hard I fell to the ground. And I looked up and it was the master teacher. He caught me. And he is totally out of control and totally livid. And he's screaming and he's cussing too. And he said, you're the one that spilled. I knew it was you. And he grabbed me. Of course, my two buddies, they took off running. He grabbed me by the collar and picked me up. And he literally drug me into the classroom. And in front of all of my friends, in front of all that classroom, he threw me up against the chalkboard. And he said, she did it. This is the one. She's been stealing your bikes. And he's just yelling at me, and I was so shocked I was ready to pass out. And he's saying, she's stealing your bike. She says, this girl is no good. She's no good. He says, I don't want anyone in this classroom to associate with her. I don't want anyone to talk to her again. This girl is evil. This girl is no good. And just before I was practically ready to pass out, I looked at the back of the room, and there sat Mr. Franklin. And he had his head lowered, and he looked up, and tears were streaming down his face. And I was just devastated, because this wonderful, wonderful person that believed in me, all of a sudden I had disappointed. And if anything I wanted to do was to prove to him that I wasn't bad, because he was the only person that ever believed in me. And as that teacher screamed at me and said, this girl is no good, I said to myself, buddy, you don't know what bad is. And I'm telling you, from then on, it was really bad. We left Southern California in the sixth grade, and we moved to Oregon. And instead of starting all over, fresh leaf, you know, new leaf, could leave the old past behind, all the trouble I'd gotten in. I moved right into the gangs. I moved right into the trouble, and it was terrible. We were living up in the logging communities. We owned a motel. My parents by now separated for a brief time, and so I literally ended up running this motel. I was in the gangs. I went to parties every night. We were in all kinds of vandalism. It got to the point it was so bad that I was wanted by the police up in Oregon for the trouble we'd gotten into. They'd give us a day off to go deer hunting. I wouldn't take a day off. I would take a month off. I literally wouldn't go to school. And I'd get my buddies and we'd go deer hunting, and we couldn't find any deer, so we would just break into people's cabins out in the woods, and for no reason at all, we'd just steal stuff out of it. Or maybe we would just be so bored we'd take a gun and just start shooting stuff up. It was just terrible. I look back at some of those things and I can hardly believe that that person was me, but that really was me. I think the hardest thing that I had to deal with at that time is that all those things that were so terrible about my dad, his drinking and his violence and everything, that's exactly what I was becoming. I literally drank so much that I would carry my vodka and my wine, and I'd take it to school and hide it in the locker, and I would drink my way from class to class. And I had all the liquor at all the parties because my mom would give me anything just so I would keep my mouth shut, just so I'd keep out of her hair. And so, hey, I was popular because I could just furnish all of us with all the liquor we wanted. And I think the hardest thing for me to realize, too, is that living in this kind of a situation, owning a motel, literally, I lived in the motel and ran the motel, and my mother slept in Unit 1 with the men. And my mother became known as the town prostitute. And I just thought, well, this is what life is, you know, and the rest of my life is going to be like this. Well, a little bit later, my parents got back together again. You know, it's interesting. People, it's hard to understand. This was a couple, my mom and dad, couldn't stand each other. I cannot recall a happy memory. I cannot recall us ever sitting at a meal and talking, carrying on conversation. I cannot recall laughter in our family. I can only recall violence. I can only recall throwing things, hitting, beating, screaming, yelling, and cussing. But even though my parents had separated, they now came back together again. It's like they couldn't live together and they couldn't live without each other. It's that addiction that we get and that so many of us get caught into. They came back together, and of course by now we had to leave Oregon. And it seemed like every time we moved, it was worse. Now my father took a job on the railroad and doing railroad construction. And railroad construction meant you lived in a trailer, you lived in the outskirts of town, you did railroad construction, you lived with all the other construction workers, and it was just drinking and parties all the time. And you were sort of one of the slum kids at school. And more than that, what it meant is you moved 7, 8, 9 times a year because you only stayed at a job about a month. I mean, there were times from 8th, 9th grade, I literally would maybe go to 4 to 5 schools a year if I went to school at all. Sometimes on the move, I say, oh, we're only going to be here a month, so I wouldn't even check into school. So you can imagine what my education was. Well, we started moving, and no matter where we moved around the United States, it was just one more. I could always find the parties. I could always get in trouble with the gangs. And yet it was kind of interesting because I was also somewhat popular because my brother and I had picked up dancing routines. So we would sort of be popular at school because we could dance. But on one of our trips, after living for now several years in this trailer on the outskirts of town, we are moving from Montana back to Indiana. And we'd only been in Montana a month. And passing through Minnesota, and I remember looking at these beautiful farmhouses, and in my fantasy, I always thought, I just hate the way we've lived. And I'll never forget as I commented to my mom, I said, can't we live in a house just like everybody else? And my mom looked at me in the car, and she says, Carolyn, why don't you just get out? I just looked at her. I mean, I was 13 years old. And she looked at me, she says, why don't you just get out? Carolyn, you've been the problem in our marriage since the day you were born. Every argument we have ever had has always been over you. And every problem we've ever had has been centered around you. She said, Carolyn, why don't you just get out? Then for the first time, I think I saw some of the feelings of my mom because she looked at me for a moment then almost pitiful. And she says, Carolyn, you've got your whole life ahead of you. I don't have anything. And would you believe my parents dropped me in the middle of Minnesota and drove off? I couldn't believe it. I mean, I didn't know what to do. There were some people there that we had met because they had worked on the railroad too. And I decided, well, I could stay at their farm. And I asked them if I could stay there. And they said, sure. And I thought, well, that's okay. My folks have left me. But in a way, I finally got my farmhouse. Here's this family. They got 2 younger kids. And I can live in a house like everybody else. I mean, I was used to being on my own anyway. In this farmhouse, though, it was only by the end of about the second day that I realized that I had just moved from one hell to a worse hell. And I found out that this man, too, was alcoholic and very abusive. And he came home 2 to 3 nights a week, totally drunk, you know, hitting everybody he could. The wife worked in a bar. She did everything to stay away from the house. And what happened was I ended up taking care of their farm. I wasn't brought into this place to be an equal member or to finally discover this house and this home I'd always wanted. I became their slave, practically. I lived up in the attic. My job was to take care of all of the chores, get up early in the morning and do all of the work. They would never venture outside. I took care of the cows and the horses and the chickens and everything right through the winter. I would lay up in my room at night and I would just think to myself, oh, I just want to run away. I just want to run away. You know, have you ever hurt so much that you didn't even know where to run to? I mean, where I can't run back to Oregon. I was in so much trouble there with the police. I was certain to get in worse trouble and probably pregnant or something terrible would happen to be back there. I mean, I didn't even know where to run away to. And I'll never forget, too, as I lay there at night, I wanted so desperately just to break and to cry. And nothing came out of the tear ducts. And it dawned on me that I had become so hardened that I literally did not know how to cry, that there wasn't a tear in me. In fact, I could not even remember for the last several years ever crying. And yet, in my spirit, there were so many things that I wanted to cry about.
She found her way to Southern California, where she continued her gang activity. But then, something happened.
Probably the greatest turning point in my life now happened at this time. I knew in my spirit that life wasn't going to be any different and that this was it for me. And yet I got a phone call one day. She introduced herself and she says, Carolyn, I was talking to your grandmother. Well, my grandmother was really unhappy with me. Obviously, her granddaughter's in trouble with the police. She's a delinquent. She's rebellious. She drinks. She runs. You know, and you know how we complain about somebody and we say, oh, how terrible they are? This lady didn't do that. She found out where I lived. She got my phone number and she calls me. She says, Carolyn, I was talking to your grandmother and she's real pleasant. She says, you know, there's about 4 miles from your home is a church that I attend. And I'd really like you to come down and visit us. You know, we've got this great youth group, a couple hundred kids. In fact, a lot of them go to your school. And when she started naming off some names, I says, oh, yeah, those kids. Well, she said, Carol, I'd love to have you come to church. Well, I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. Church? I tried to burn one of those things down. You know, I don't want anything to do with a church. I finally says, no, I'm not interested. No, I'm kind of doing my thing. Church is not my thing. Well, this was Tuesday. I could not get Gene Fauner out of my mind. Even though I had a party that night and the next day and all the Thursday, I get another telephone call. Guess what? Same lady. I thought, how persistent. She went through the whole story again, telling me about this wonderful church, the youth group. She says, Carolyn, I think you would really enjoy it. I think there's something down there that you would really like. And of course, by now, I'm really angry at her. A part of me was curious, but another part of me was angry that this lady, this stubborn lady, wouldn't give up on me. And yet, I didn't notice a stubbornness. She was just real sweet and gentle. I cussed her out. I didn't want to have anything to do with her. Saturday, there's a knock on the door, and it was Gene Fauner. I could not believe it. Invited her in, and again, she says, Carolyn, I just really think that, you know, if you ever wanted to go to church and talk to me about going to church. And I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get this lady off my back is say that I might go. And she says, great. She says, do you mind if I pray for you right now? And this lady sat there in front of me and prayed for me and walked out the door. I could not believe it. The next day, Sunday occurs. Well, you know, there's sometimes you just don't know why you do what you do. And I was feeling really lonely and really down and everything. And I went for a walk. And would you believe, next thing I know, I am 4 miles away standing across the street from this church. The church looks so much like the one I tried to burn down. It was a shock. But I watched those people walk in, and I couldn't believe it. And finally, next thing you know, I don't even know how I got there, but next thing I know, I'd walked across the street, and I'm standing just next to the building because I noticed a lot of the kids that I had seen at school were walking into this one little room. And, of course, there was this nice-looking kid out front, too, and I thought I'd check him out. A good-looking, he looked like he was a football player or something like that. And I'm just watching, staying at a safe distance, and all of a sudden this good-looking blonde kid sees me, and he kind of grins and starts walking my way. So I stayed there, and he walked up, and he says, "Hi, my name is Skip." And I was a little hesitant, but I says, "Hi, my name's Carolyn Coons." He says, "Carolyn?" He said, "It was my mom who was at your house. My name's Skip Fawner." I go, "Oh, no." And he says, come on inside with us. And before I realized what happened, this guy walked me inside. And here, there must have been about 65, 75 really energetic high school kids my own age in this room. A few of them I recognized, and some of them recognized me, and you could just see their shock as I walked in the door. He walked me right up to the second row, introduced me to a bunch of kids. They scooted over, and I sat down. And then in walks this really energetic Sunday school teacher. And all of a sudden, he starts with, and all of his charisma and everything starts telling me about, and all of us in there, but I guess I thought he was just talking to me. He starts talking about Jesus and about God and how he loves us. And he was so excited. And everybody in the room, as I watched them, they seemed so excited. And, you know, I don't think I ever saw so many smiles in my life. Well, I walked out of there saying, "I've got to get out of this place. This is not safe for me." You know, because when you've grown up on the streets and you've been tried to be so much in control of your own destiny and your own person, you're not about to give in to anything or anybody. And I literally started to walk out the room. Everyone says, "Oh, come on, Carolyn, go to church with us." Next thing I know, I'm sitting in church. Well, that was worse because everything that preacher up there said, I knew he was talking just to me. But in the same way, there was this real battle going on inside of me that says, I know what he's saying. I know that that's what I've been looking for, but I can't give in. And as I walked out of the church, a bunch of the kids invited me back that night. And I says, "No way." And I says, "I'm not ever, ever coming back to this church again." Well, a knock on my door that afternoon, and they picked me up, and off I went back to the church. I literally kept these antics up for a good month. They drugged me back, and I said, "I'm not coming back." I don't know. You know, maybe God knew that this stubborn Carolyn Coons, this person that didn't trust anybody, that didn't trust Christians, that didn't trust churches, maybe he knew that that's the kind of people that I needed in my life, those people that would just hang in there with me no matter how much guff I gave them. By the end of a month, on a Sunday night, I knew that this is what I needed. It's the thing that absolutely turned my life around. It was as if God just picked up my life and turned my life around. And it was just absolutely incredible because I realized for the first time I had something to live for. I began to get in touch with my feelings and my emotions. And you know what? I'll never forget that night. First time I had cried in years. All of a sudden it was like the emotions just broke. And I wasn't controlling, you know, I wasn't uncontrollable sobs, but just tears just kept streaming down my face.
You're listening to Scan. Carolyn was born to abusive alcoholic parents. Abandoned at age 13, she was forced to fend for herself. She was invited to a church that ultimately helped her to know that God had not abandoned her. She finished high school and college and became a professor at a university.
And it's like, aha, I've left my past behind. I haven't seen my parents in years. I still would hear rumors about my father and his violent alcoholic behavior and on and on. There was still this whole part of me that was a tremendous secret to people. I still, well into my adulthood, I was not about to let anybody know anything about Carolyn Coons. There was a part of me that was a real mystery. But boy, that all came crushing down when I am sitting in the office at school in my nice, wonderful office, and I get a phone call, and it was the switchboard operator at the university, and she said a sentence that absolutely shocked me. She said, "Is your dad still alive?" And I never, ever mentioned my dad. I never talked about my parents. And I said, "Why do you ask?" She says, "Well, Carolyn, I just got the strangest phone call. This man, some man, sounds like he's really angry, really upset. Just call the switchboard and ask if you still work here. And Carolyn, I told him you did. Is that okay? And I mean, chills just went through me. And she said, Carolyn, he said to leave you a message. I said, what's the message? She said, he said to tell you he's on his way for you this time, and this time it's for good. Carolyn, what does that mean? I'm telling you, I knew what that meant. That meant that my dad, who had threatened me all these years, really was after me. And I mean, he was so angry toward me. It wasn't until many years that I discovered why. I discovered that I was illegitimate. And that he basically came home from World War II, and there I was. And I was this continual reminder to him of unfaithfulness. And of course, it was just sort of that. I was this symbol, this mark, that he just almost had to vent all of his anger and all of his frustration on. Even though, you know, it wasn't my fault, but this is the kind of person he was. Well, I knew when my dad said he was on his way that he could be on that campus in 45 minutes. Well, I'm telling you, I hung up the phone and I walked out of that office and off of that campus as fast as I could be. I did not want to be around that campus. And I started driving and I said, God, where can I run? I thought, well, I know some friends that have a cabin up in the mountains. I could go hide out for a couple of weeks. But then I thought, how terrible to go hide out in the mountains by myself. And I was working in a church, and so I went over and I just sat there for a while, and I kept looking at my watch knowing that the minutes were ticking away. And finally I just said, I'm not going to run anymore. And then I said, Lord, if you love me, you are going to have to take care of me. Instead of running and hiding in the mountains, I went over to my condominium. First of all, I checked all around to see if my dad had already arrived, because he could have. And then I got into my condominium, and I locked myself in, and I sat there, and I waited. I waited for my dad to come with a gun. I knew it wouldn't help me to call the police or anything. They weren't going to do anything until something happened. And so I just waited. I waited into the night. I remember looking out the windows, wondering if, well, is he standing out there behind that oak tree, or is he hiding behind the light? Where is he? And way all through the night, I sat there, and I waited for him. I'm telling you, there's sometimes things in our life happen that literally just flood our and bring back all those memories. Sitting there through that night, all of those painful memories of the past, all of the beatings, all of the rejection, all, you know, the gun, the getting kicked out of my home. I mean, they were as vivid as if they occurred that day. And I knew that I no longer could bury them. I knew that I was going to have to really deal with these. I got a phone call at 5:30, and it was my sister-in-law. She said, Carolyn, she says, I've got some news for you. She said, I've just returned from emergency hospital, and your dad's in the hospital. I said, what? She says, yeah, he was at work yesterday. He'd been drinking all day. They said he got really angry. He made a phone call, left work, and drove away. And she said that about a mile or so from work at a stoplight, he had a stroke. Now, he's alive. But Carolyn, don't come. I knew not to come.
This is Scan. Carolyn overcame her parents' abuse and neglect and her own criminal behavior to become a university professor. But those experiences continued to haunt her.
We had this wonderful older couple that were some friends of ours that we kind of referred to as Grandma and Grandpa. And they had tremendous insight, and yet they were very wise, and they would watch me. And they started talking about real inner healing, and that maybe one of these days I needed to real think about just getting in touch with the past. And of course, my defenses were still up. But boy, when this thing happened with my dad, I knew that they were right. You know, it's like sometimes people tell us things and we're not ready to listen and we're not ready for that step. But then all of a sudden something comes along and we're saying, you know, all along we knew we really needed it. Well, I was ready. So for the first time, we got a few ladies together and we just spent some time just really walking through the past and getting in touch with those pains. And it's in this continual process, it's like cleaning out all of the tremendous pain and all the tremendous garbage and all the tremendous guilt and all the tremendous abscess. And now it's easier because the scarring and stuff is so much smaller as a continual process. Anyway, it's not a crutch anymore. And a lot of it has to do with our choice of our past. It can be the crutch or it can be a rod of power. Or, you know, our past literally can break us. And I think the hardest thing for me to see is someone who is so broken by their past that their life becomes wasted because they just feel like, oh, this happened to me and I can never live beyond this. Or you have no idea the abuse I went through, or my father or so-and-so did this to me. And it can be a tremendous weakness, and they will live the rest of their life in this weakness. Or the past can be turned around by the grace of God, and with the proper healing, it can be a tremendous strength. And so the past can help other people come through their past, or it can encourage other people. And so it comes down to the fact that, sure, we've all gone through traumas and pains in one form or another. And, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot of people that have not gone through what I've gone through, but yet there's a far more people who have gone through even worse things or things that I won't understand. But yet the choice is ours to get the healing, and the choice is ours to really let God come in and be the total healer and to be the healing salve of that pain, and for us to just finally just let it go. And I think the letting go of the pain and to letting go of the terrible memories is a real key. People say, well, Carolyn, isn't it hard for you now to talk about your past? Doesn't it bring up all of the pain? No, you know, it really doesn't now. Now I look at my past. Sure, the memories are there. Memories will always be there. Once a memory, once we've experienced something and once the memory is there, we will always know that memory and experience that memory. That's still there. The pain has been lifted. And it's so refreshing, and the pain literally has been healed. And so now I can look back at my past and I can say, Lord, you know, you're really using my past. If anything, if I could be of any kind of encouragement to anybody that says, no matter what your age, no matter what the scarring, no matter what the abuse, it's terrible. But we know that God is the healer, and He wants us to get in touch with our past. Not to avoid it, but He just wants to get in touch with us, and He wants to be the healer of healers, and if anything, He wants to set us free. We need crisis to make us move. Sometimes we really do need crisis to make us move. It's easy to hold on. It's easy to hold on to those pains because it makes it easier for the excuses that we use or the behaviors that we have. Sometimes people just like almost living in the pain. Even though they don't like it, they like it. They know it. You live in the familiarity with it. You say, you know, I don't like this. This is terrible, but at least I'm familiar with it, and I've tolerated all these years, and I am functional. And so in their functional, sure, they're functional, but wouldn't it be great if they were literally set free? One of the most incredible things that happened to me, too, is on one of the missionary trips that I was taking about 500 high school and college kids into Mexico. We were working in various missions and prisons and orphanages, and we discovered down there a boys' prison. We discovered a prison that had 300 boys in it from the age of 5 years old through 17. And in this prison, we discovered one of the cutest little kids that had been put in prison at the age of 5 years old for murder. This little boy, whose mother was a prostitute, who had, you know, every child she had was from a different man, and her youngest little baby was found beaten to death one night, and they accused her son, her five-year-old little Tony, as the murderer. And we found this little boy in prison. This kid had been in prison for 7 years. And they were going to keep him in there for the rest of his life. And it was interesting. I saw that boy, and it reminded me so much of my own type of emotional prison that I had been into. And I remember when I was younger, I just sort of wished that someone would come along and take me out of this prison, take me out of this farmhouse, take me out of this pain. And when I saw this little Antonio in the prison, he reminded me so much of me. And I had just said, God, I'm ready for a new challenge, and I want you to change my life. And I found this boy in the prison, and God said, Carolyn, I prepared you to help this kid. And I actually got him out for another couple to adopt. But by the time I finally got him out, this couple changed their mind. And God said, Carolyn, you asked me to change your life. And so here I am. At that time, I was 35 years old. I didn't, obviously, I did not know what it meant to be a mother. You know, I mean, I didn't even know what it was to have a house or a family or anything. But yet it was interesting. I knew that this is what God wanted. And so I adopted Tony. Hear this. 35-year-old, single, never married person adopts a boy that just spent 7 years of his life in prison for murder. And I'm telling you, that started my life on a whole new era or a whole new season. And that was probably the point that I had reached the top of my life professionally, and within a couple of years had just about reached the bottom, because there were so many things that was happening in Tony's life and my trying to help him. And I thought, oh, well, I'm tough. I'm off the streets. All this kid needs to do is listen to this wise woman who's been through this, and God's changed my life. And all he has to do is listen to me, and his life will be straightened out. And it wasn't that way at all. And I began to realize that things were not going well between us. And then God showed me that what he was trying to do was not just change Tony's life, but he was trying to change my life.
You've been listening to a remix version of SCAN, an electronic sweep of the horizon, discovering God's activity in the world. We featured Carolyn Coons, who adopted a troubled child and through their shared pain found redemption. SCAN is a production of Select Learning, a continuing education program of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.